across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net.
Before we get started on the interviews, though, we want to mention our sponsors. Legal Help for Veterans, a veterans disability law firm handling claims all around the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or LegalHelpForVeterans.com. Our VSO sponsors include Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter, 310 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, American Legion Post 46 out of Ann Arbor, the VFW Graft O'Hara Post 423, and U.S. Wings, which provides those great giveaway leather bomber jackets. They've been online for decades now, and you can find them at uswings.com. We also want to encourage you to go to our website, veteransradio.net, and help us out with a few sponsorships, maybe some buddy money, maybe being involved in buying some of our new swag at the veteransradio.net swag store. That also helps promote and keep this program on the air. We're going to start our interview today with Corrine Wegner, who is the director of the Smithsonian Cultural Rescue Initiative. I think you'll find that fascinating. And our second interview after the news will be about Navy warbirds that crashed into Lake Michigan and have been recovered over these many decades. Another fascinating story of military history and local Michigan history, so stay tuned for that as well. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Corrine Wegner, who's wearing a lot of hats, but let me just start with Corrine, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, this is a first. I don't know that we've talked to any art experts, so this is really an opportunity to follow up on a few different things. But let me get you introduced to the audience. You currently are the director at the Smithsonian Cultural Rescue Initiative. Everybody knows the Smithsonian, so right there we're all going, wow, that's one smart lady. You have your bachelor's from the University of Nebraska and a couple of master's degrees from the University of Kansas, both in political science and art history, and uniquely qualified to talk about this issue today on art, antiquities, the importance of cultural sites and war zones, is the fact that you are a U.S. Army Reserve officer, a retired major after I think it was 22 years. And in that role, you also served as an Arts, Monuments, and Archives officer for the U.S. Army. Wow, what a background.
Yeah, it's not your usual route to success in the world, I know, but you don't find too many art historians in the Army Reserve or the Army today, but I was really in some ways inspired by the career path of Army Civil Affairs and the work that they do in connecting to the civilian communities in places where the U.S. military is operating. But also, I was inspired by the World War II Monuments Men as well.
Well, you've made one heck of a career out of this juxtaposition of interest in art and history and military affairs. How did you get involved in the military to begin with?
I joined the Army Reserve. I enlisted in the Army Reserve right out of high school. So I enlisted in 82, I think it was, and had a short career as an enlisted soldier, and then I went through the ROTC program at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, go Mavericks, and then later kind of gradually got into it through political science and art history, and I worked for many years as a curator at the Minneapolis Institute of Art while I was having an Army Reserve career at the same time.
Very fulfilling, I'm sure, and gave you a lot of different experiences. Why don't you explain to folks who might not be aware of what civil affairs is all about in today's U.S. Army?
So civil affairs is a branch of the Army. There are a small number of active component civil affairs units at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and a couple of other places. And then we have the vast majority of civil affairs is in the U.S. Army Reserve under the U.S. Army Reserve Command. and they're spread out across the United States. And basically, I mean, to put it simply, we serve as the liaisons between the civilian community, the international organizations, NGOs, and other groups that might be working in a theater of operations, as well as with the local stakeholders. And we try to be that liaison between the combatant commanders and that civilian community, and provide information to the commanders and a lot of civilian expertise that you might not find anywhere else in the Army.
And this has become an extremely important aspect of, I suppose, modern warfare, where the Army's in for a prolonged period of time in countries like Afghanistan and Iraq. But it has a deeper, longer history as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, the U.S. military started the Civil Affairs Division in 1943, recognizing that the U.S. military would need to govern those occupied countries as the war was being won in Europe and Asia. And so we had to provide military governance in places like Germany, Austria, Italy, Japan. And so that was how the Civil Affairs branch was really born. But it even goes back further than that. We just celebrated the 100th anniversary of Civil Affairs, which goes back to the recognition around the time of World War I that Civil Affairs, that understanding the civilian environment in which you're operating was important to victory and also to securing the victory, which that's the Civil Affairs motto, secure the victory.
Well, I promised our listeners on Veterans Radio we're going to talk about the Smithsonian aspect, which everybody's going, I don't get it yet, but we're going to get there. But you have such an interesting history and background. I want to talk about your work in the Army Reserves in the 2003 period of time, looking at it as a civil affairs officer when the looting was going on at the Iraq National Museum. Can you give us any insights into that?
So in 2003, I was serving in the 407th Civil Affairs Battalion in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and was scheduled to go to Afghanistan. And about the same time, though, the U.S. was undertaking the invasion of Iraq, and I was kind of watching that closely, along with my husband, who was also serving the 407th with me. And we saw on television the looting of the Iraq Museum, and I was working at the Minneapolis Institute of Art at the time and serving, you know, in civil affairs, and I thought, there's something I could do to help in this situation. And while I wished I'd been involved from the beginning planning process, you know, I wanted to be involved in it from then on and try and help in any way I could. So I got deployed by USAKPOC just after the museum was looted and sent directly to Baghdad to join the 352nd Civil Affairs Command, and started working with this with the team that was working directly with the Ministry of Culture. And we tried to do as much as we could to stabilize the situation and to also work with other cultural heritage organizations in Iraq that needed help.
Talk to us a little bit, Corin, about the, if you will, macro view of why it's important that these cultural treasures be protected and recognized when there's war raging in the region.
Well, I think we can all recognize the importance of cultural heritage and our own cultural identity in our daily lives, how it connects us to our history of our families, to our communities, and even to our nations. And in times of armed conflict or other types of disasters, floods, hurricanes, it's even more important to us because we may experience terrible losses in our lives at a time when we can't really afford to also lose our identity at the same time. And so I often liken it to, think about if you had a house fire, and as soon as you know that your family's safe and your pets are safe, what are the first things that you think about trying to recover out of the wreckage that's your home? And it's those things you can't replace: your family heirlooms, the family Bible, the historic documents that you might not be able to replace, you know, through modern digitization. So magnify that to a whole community or a whole country, and you can kind of start to see the importance of of having at least some focus on this while you're in a humanitarian crisis. There are lots of organizations that take care of people in disaster situations, but there are far fewer that help those people look after their heritage while they're trying to recover. So that's a little bit in a macro view.
In this activity in 2003 in Iraq really impacted you so that by 2006 you were saying that the U.S. has to get more involved in the awareness of the 1954 Hague Convention for the Protection of Cultural Property in the event of armed conflict. Can you talk a little bit about that sort of, it looks like 3 or 4 years of your life trying to say, hey, this is important and we shouldn't let it happen again if we can avoid it?
Yeah, that was kind of my goal. In Iraq, I gradually learned that the U.S. had never ratified the 1954 Hague Convention, even though we were intimately involved in the drafting of that treaty after World War II. And even parts of the treaty refer, you can see references where they're talking about the successes of the World War II Monuments Men. And so I was frankly surprised that while we were following the treaty as customary international law, we had never ratified the treaty. And so I realized the importance of, when you're in an allied coalition, of everybody being on the same page with that. And we had Italian allies and others who were subject to the convention, and it caused some friction within the coalition that some of these important cultural sites were damaged. And I also saw how civil affairs, while we had a lot of expertise to offer, we were very short on those who could talk about cultural heritage at the, you know, national level like that. So I was determined when I came home that we would try to work toward helping the military understand more and do more training, because I feel like that's a responsibility of cultural professionals like myself, but also how nationally we should probably be a states party to the Hague Convention. And we created a group called the U.S. Committee of the Blue Shield. The Blue Shield's the international symbol for the Hague Convention. It's kind of like the Red Cross is to the Geneva Convention. And we started lobbying Congress, and this was a long time ago, before I started working at the Smithsonian. And finally, everybody recognized this was an important thing, and the United States ratified the Hague Convention in 2009.
Now, I'm going to back up to one more historical point, and I promise we're going to get to this, what's the Smithsonian's doing. I'm not teasing the listeners here. We're talking to Corinne Wagner, who's the current director of the Smithsonian Cultural Rescue Initiative. She's a retired Army Reserve major after serving 22 years in civil affairs. But you've mentioned twice the Monuments Men of World War II. And why don't you give us the little history of that for those who may not recall either the history or the movie?
Well, so in brief, during World War II, and as the Allies were starting to take territory in Europe, there was a big recognition that, first of all, the Nazi regime had done a lot of looting of cultural property, both on the national level as well as from private individuals that were being sent to concentration camps and things like that. So gradually they made a selection of cultural professionals, many of whom were already serving in the military but in other areas, and pulled them together to create the Monuments, Fine Arts, and Archives teams, also known as the Monuments Men. And so they worked from that time in 1943, attached on to the divisions, and also working in areas after the occupation of Germany and Austria. And they created these collecting points where they brought looted art to return it to their countries of origin after the war.
So that's the history, and now we find ourselves at a time when the Army Reserve has reached out to the Smithsonian Institution and said, maybe there's more we can do here, maybe there's some more training we can do. Can you tell us how this came about and what the goals are?
Sure. So it came about, civil affairs never stopped having responsibility for cultural property protection after World War II. It's been in every one of the civil affairs field manuals since 1943. But as you can imagine, in today's all-volunteer force, there's not as many people who are available to fill those slots. And then a few years ago, there was a big push to strengthen the civil sector expertise within civil affairs, because, as I mentioned earlier, they have a responsibility for military government in times of occupation, but also to be able to advise commanders on governance issues in the host nations. So they created what's called the 38 Gulf Program. It's a sort of a branch within civil affairs, which that job designator is 38 Alpha. Well, these 38 Gulfs are all supposed to be civil sector experts in about 18 areas of expertise, two of which have to deal with cultural property. There's one on culture and heritage, and there's one on archives. So I've kind of stayed in touch with the civil affairs community. I'm on the board of the Civil Affairs Association and have kept up with what's going on with civil affairs. And I was one of the people that they asked to help develop and strengthen these 38 Gulf positions. And now they're really actively seeking people to fill these positions. And the Smithsonian said, hey, why don't we do some training, some cross-training with some of your 38 Gulf experts that you already have, and see if we can't recruit some new people from across the military who might want to come into civil affairs, and let's have some training together and cooperate on creating training opportunities and training aids. And so this is what we're doing, and we just signed an MOU on that back in October. So we're really looking forward to working with USA KPOC, U.S. Army Civil Affairs and Psychological Operations Command, and the Smithsonian.
I think it highlights the importance of this issue when you do sign a memorandum of understanding between the Army and an institution like the Smithsonian, says we're going to train folks up so there's sort of a more scholarly approach to this issue. And it probably gives the civil affairs officers a little more credibility within their chain of command, I would think.
Yeah, and we're trying to create a network where we have sort of a safe space for folks who are in the military and people who are working in the cultural heritage profession to come together and make a network and network with other areas of expertise that overlap with the cultural heritage issues. Infrastructure, rule of law, emergency management, these are some of the other 38 Gulf civil sector experts that we have in civil affairs. And so we know that there are a lot of areas of overlap, especially where the U.S. is operating in other countries. And then we want to also bring in the interagency, our colleagues at Department of State, USAID, and there's a lot we can do just to serve. We're right there on the Mall here in Washington, D.C., and we can serve as a convening space for the interagency on this topic.
Again, in a bigger, broader macro approach, I mean, I think we talk about winning the war and then winning the hearts and minds of people so that, you know, you got to win the peace. And if you are not safeguarding or if you're causing their cultural heritage to be destroyed, I don't know how you win the hearts and minds of those folks where you're trying to win the peace. Is that a little bit of what the thinking is here?
Yeah, that's definitely it. I mean, the 1954 Hague Convention offers a legal requirement on protecting cultural heritage and armed conflict. It's part of the law of war. But anybody who is, you know, a military veteran or who is currently serving in the military understands that you have to understand the people and the place that you're operating in. If you want to understand the people, go to their museums, go to their cultural sites, learn more about their history. And if you ignore the cultural aspect of what's going on in your area of operations, you're missing out on a lot of information. And as you said, it's really hard to say, gosh, we're here from, you know, the government, we're here to help you. Sorry that we accidentally damaged one of your most sacred historic sites. It just doesn't go over too well. So what we're trying to do is give tools for military operators to do their mission better, to do their job better, to be able to advise their commanders in such a way that can really make a difference in stabilizing communities and in working, you know. And we have a lot of important things going on that involve conflict and that involve military operations. We're not ignoring that, but going into that with a full set of tools and understandings about the culture you're going into, is it can be really helpful, and we want to offer that.
Well, and as I was looking at the materials, we're talking to Corinne Wegner, who's the director at the Smithsonian. It seemed to me also that this isn't just about, hey, avoiding where we're dropping bombs, but there's putting resources on the ground to stop looting, which may be being done by the local population, also is important and necessary for the Army to recognize, yeah, we need to stop that looting because a few bad actors are going to cause a larger cultural problem. And I think that's what you probably saw in 2003 at the Iraq National Museum.
Yeah, and it's, you know, there's a duty to prevent looting just across civilian infrastructure in general, and understanding what those important places are that might be highly at risk, like cultural sites where there are items of value that have a high, you know, market resale on the black market and things like that. And that those could also be places where weapons are stored, or those could be places where, you know, other valuable things are. But the idea primarily is that we work together before there's an armed conflict. And that's the kind of premise of the Hague Convention, is that each country who's signed on to the Hague Convention to protect cultural property in armed conflict has a plan before there's a conflict, before there's a disaster, and enables those local communities to protect their own heritage sites. And here in the U.S., we're talking about, you know, our responsibilities under the Hague Convention to take protective measures and have emergency plans for our own cultural heritage here in the U.S. And so when it comes to preventing looting, we're hoping that the first level is the local host nation has a plan, and we can help them fortify that plan. But, you know, in worst-case scenarios, there may have to be resources allocated to that if it's possible. But that's the thing. We want commanders to know what the risks are and what the benefits are, and be able to take a really educated decision about that.
Let me shift from armed conflict to another area that I see that you've written and spoken on, and as a civil affairs officer, you'd know a lot about. And I think many people don't realize how many humanitarian missions the military does, the United States military does, whether it's hurricane relief or what have you. There's a lot of humanitarian missions that go on. Haiti's maybe a good example of it. But this issue of protecting cultural heritage also comes up in those natural disaster zones that the Army shows up at. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Mm-hmm. So if you talk about how the Smithsonian got involved in providing cultural heritage protection and response in disasters, the Haiti earthquake was kind of that origin story in a way for the Smithsonian Cultural Rescue Initiative program, in that there was a humanitarian mission from the U.S. military as part of a pre-existing U.N. peacekeeping operation. And so we already had a lot of U.S. military on the ground, and they were able to really, in effect, quickly and effectively help Haiti in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake, which killed nearly, I mean, this is just mind-boggling, killed at least 250,000 people in a very brief time. And so it was an overwhelming humanitarian crisis, with the overlay that they were already in an unstable political environment that had conflict elements to it. So the U.S. military humanitarian response usually is pretty limited to life-saving and alleviating human suffering. And in a natural disaster, USAID is in the lead of that, and then the DOD is in support. But we were able to come not too long after the earthquake as the Smithsonian, in cooperation with the U.S. Embassy in Haiti and with the U.S. military mission on the ground, and to do some coordinating and collaborating on how we could work together. And the military got permission from, you know, got an order to assist us in any way they could, and we were able to work with them to find stable housing and things like that. So there is a great possibility for collaboration on this, human lives come first, that humanitarian mission early on. We don't want to get in the way of that or interfere with that in any way. Usually we look at coming on a few weeks later and helping advise our colleagues as best we can until we can get there to assist.
Well, it's all very interesting, and it's great to hear that there's an increase in coordination on this important issue. We've been talking to the director of the Smithsonian Cultural Rescue Initiative, Corinne Wagner, who's also a retired Army Reserve Major in Civil Affairs after 22 years, and how the Smithsonian is going to be doing some training with the Army Reserves to assist in this area. Corinne, this is really interesting stuff. We're glad the Smithsonian's involved and that you had a chance to spotlight or highlight what the Army Reserves is doing. If people want to know more information about the Smithsonian Cultural Rescue Initiative or about the Army Reserves and maybe its civil affairs area, where might you direct them?
Yeah, they can just check out our website. It's culturalrescue.si.edu.
Well, we thank you for spending some time with Veterans Radio today.
Thanks a lot, Jim. I really appreciate you having me on.
You simply can't get that kind of information anywhere else but on Veterans Radio. So stay tuned after the news and hear about the Navy warbirds that were sunk and are being retrieved from the Lake Michigan area off of or outside of Chicago. So come on back.
Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. It was Staff Sergeant Henry Irwin's job on the lead B-29 to drop a phosphorus canister as a marker when they reached the assembly area over enemy territory. Details after this. Irwin positioned the canister in the launch tube and pulled the pin at the pilot's orders. The flare dropped and then flew back into the plane. It exploded in Irwin's face, spewing flames just feet away from tons of incendiary bombs. Smoke filled the aircraft momentarily, blinding the pilot and co-pilot and putting the plane in a steep dive. Irwin dropped to his knees and, unable to see, felt for the canister. Although it was burning at 1,300 degrees, he picked it up, cradled it to his body, and began crawling to the cockpit. He yelled to the co-pilot to open the window and threw the flare out. The crew then turned its fire extinguisher on him and began to feed plasma into his arm. Doctors were sure he was going to die and transferred him to Guam. Major General Curtis LeMay recommended him for the Medal of Honor and got authorities to expedite the award so it could be presented before he died. 1 week after the attack, LeMay presented the medal to Irwin at a bedside ceremony attended by the rest of his crew and his brother. Irwin surprised doctors by surviving. He was flown home to Alabama, where he was hospitalized for 2.5 years and underwent numerous operations. Henry Irwin died on January 16, 2002. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
We want to talk about an upcoming event in the Southeast Michigan area that you should know about. The 75th World War II anniversary of VE Day, Victory in Europe, is coming up. And on May 8th, American House, a senior living community at its location in Dearborn Heights, is going to have a celebration for our living World War II veterans, those at the house and those in the community. So if you'd like to participate, it's from 12 p.m., so noon until 3 p.m. on Friday, May 8th. There'll be a speaker and a band and some recognition of these American heroes. So it's the American House Senior Living Community at 26600 Ann Arbor Trail in Dearborn Heights, Michigan. You can RSVP by calling 248-912-3000. 3237. They would love you to bring out your grandfather to or father to this celebration. It might be the last time he gets a chance to get recognized. There'll be some particular momentums for that recognition. So come to the American House in Dearborn Heights for that 75th World War II VE anniversary commemoration on May 8th, and call in your RSVP at 248-912-3237. And Veterans Radio's own Brigadier General Carol Ann Fossone, retired, will be the master of ceremonies. Now let's turn to our interview. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Taras Lysenko, a Army veteran who, with his colleague Alan Olson, are the founders and owners of A&T Recovery, which has is involved in a fascinating slice of military history. Taras, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start, because you both are Army veterans. Why don't we start there, and then we'll come back around to how you got yourself involved in this interesting endeavor. So tell us about your military experience.
Well, I'm a commissioned officer, branched infantry, ranger qualified, and it was a fun part of my life, interesting part of my life. And in the 80s under Ronald Reagan, so it was I called him the great commander. I don't know what other people called him, but that's what I called him. Al is considerably older than me. He is actually considered Vietnam era, but he didn't participate in Vietnam. And he worked on, I think it was Pershing missiles in Germany. It was maintenance on Pershing missiles in Germany. So that's pretty much it.
That's a great experience for what you were doing at A&T Recovery. Not really. It has nothing to do with what you do at A&T Recovery. So let's talk about how a couple of Chicago boys dreamed up the idea about A&T Recovery.
We are – you just used the term boys. And I try to get this across to people to always see the world through the eyes of a child. Sometimes they say the eyes of a puppy. If you notice puppies and children, they have this great sense of wonder about everything they see. And the trouble is we become adults and we lose that sense of wonder. And we get into this routine of just going to work 9 to 5 for 40 years and planning for retirement. And that is something we never, ever, ever thought about. And there was a philosopher named Alan Watts, and I had never heard of him until recently, but he did this wonderful thing. What do you desire? Alan Watts, what do you desire? And he said, we have it all wrong. And I think Al and I and the rest of our crew all along knew that we all had it wrong. And what we should do as humans, we should not just exist, we should really live. And a way to live is to do what you desire. And so we have always sort of looked at the world like through the eyes of a child, just looking for wonder. What's around the rock? What's under the rock? Under that rock? What's around the side of that mountain? We've always explored no matter where we are. You can drop us in any part of the planet and we'll start exploring almost instantly. There was a comic strip years ago, Calvin and Hobbes, where I give students, when I give a presentation, I give them a copy of the one where he's digging in the ground and his stuffed tiger says to him, why are you digging that hole in the ground? He said, I'm hunting for treasure. And the tiger asks him, have you found anything? And he says, a bunch of disgusting grubs, these worms, these rocks, there's treasure everywhere. And that's kind of how we look at things. We just know there's some sort of interesting something. You can call it treasure or whatever you want to call it, but there's something everywhere to be seen and discovered.
Well, what you were discovering, and again, this started when you guys were just young men, was this idea that there were World War II aircraft that had crashed in Lake Michigan off of the Chicago area because of the training that was done outside Chicago to make folks aircraft carrier qualified. So tell us a little bit about kind of how that piqued your interest.
Well, so this is before before we did college and military, and before we did that, and we were at least I was a teenager. Maybe I actually I kept correct that Al actually had done that stuff, and I was still the teenager. And so we were scuba divers from early on, young ages. We became scuba divers. And just so you know, we went to the same grade school, the same high school, kind of thing. So I've known Al since I was 3 years old when I moved onto the street where he was already living on with his family. But we actually were scuba divers, and Al had this idea of buying this boat that was pretty bad. I swear it was literally held together with duct tape. And so we went out of the lake. We knew about the ships. We knew Chicago had been one of the busiest ports in the 1800s. So we were looking for ships, and a scuba group located a TBF Avenger, torpedo bomber, Avenger type, the type that George Bush, senior would have flown in the war. And so that's when we found out about the aircraft. Well, we shifted our attention, and it didn't take us long. It was less than a year. Al and I located a Wildcat fighter. So we actually turned that over to a private salvage company, and they actually salvaged it for a guy named Talajay, who owns those, I think it's 57 Aero Squadron restaurants, and he made a deal with the Navy that he could have it or whatever. I don't know exactly the details because I was young and flippant. I was still a teenager. And so anyway, I college, military, and came back, and Al said, you know, we should turn this looking for the aircraft into a business. And I had money, he had money, and we bought a much better boat, and we bought the equipment needed, which was called side scan sonar, to actually find the aircraft. And boy, did we find aircraft.
It's really, yeah, it's really amazing how many you've found, and we're going to talk about those. And these are all in a book that Taras has written called The Great Navy Birds of Lake Michigan.
Yes, thank you for the pitch of the book.
Oh, no, it's the capturing the true story of the privateers of Lake Michigan and the aircraft they rescued. Well, you rescued over 40 or so aircraft from Lake Michigan and elsewhere. But this isn't an easy – a couple of things here. This isn't – they're not easy to find, and then you get into this whole issue of who really owns them. Let's start with – these aren't easy to find, are they?
They're not easy to find, and it's all about logistics. And one thing – I'm the gregarious public face of A&T Recovery, but Al is the electronic – how you put the vessel and the equipment together to do it expert. I would say he's a genius with electronics. It's amazing. And then together with our other crew members, Keith Pearson and Paul and Bruce, and we a number of others, they're able to fabricate anything needed on the fly. When we're operating, we're Army. We get into trouble, something goes wrong, we don't quit. We figure out how to fix it.
Right? There's always another way up that hill, isn't there?
There always. Yeah. You might be digging under it, right? Well, you might be tunneling. Who knows?
Right? And reading the book, one of the interesting things is you do hit. Okay, you found it. Okay, side scan radar helped you out. The ship logs probably didn't help you out. Where exactly it crashed? Nobody GPSed it at the time. There's no black box that's working for you. All of that, you find it.
We still find it.
Now you have to pick it up off the ground. Yeah, pick it out of the lake bottom. Not an easy task, is it?
No, and it's not an easy task because of our wonderful, and I don't want to complain at all, but our government has grown, has too many tentacles interfering with too much stuff where they shouldn't, and they should sometimes just sit back and let us do what we do. And every bureaucrat needs to put their stamp of approval on it. And so I say my book is really – the title is misleading. It's not really so much in my mind about the aircraft. It's about American humanities. It's an actual micro study of – well, my observation, my personal view of how our government doesn't really help ourselves. It doesn't let us help ourselves. So the aircraft are owned by the U.S. Navy. All right. And therefore the American population. And the reason for that is I use an example. I say, if you're walking through a parking lot of a grocery store and you drop your wallet and someone else finds it, it's not their wallet. It's still your wallet, right? You lost it. Same thing applies to the aircraft. The U.S. government lost the aircraft in Lake Michigan. And so you have to go to the U.S. government and say, specifically the Navy, and say, we'd like to do something with this. And they have to grant you permission. They can either divest themselves of ownership. Now, for years, we've had this thing called admiralty law, the laws of fines and the laws of salvage, which says, doesn't say you own it because you found it underwater. It says the owner should compensate you for helping what's been lost, return what's lost. So we actually were able to work with the National Naval Aviation Museum. I think I said that right. National Naval Aviation Museum director and deputy director. In those days, it was Captain Robert Rasmussen and Buddy Macon. That was the director and the deputy director. And they found a way for us to work with the U.S. Navy to recover those 40 or so aircraft. And because of their determination, as well as ours, we were able to get all those aircraft recovered, restored, on display at almost two dozen prestigious museums across the country, including their museum, the National Museum of the United States Marine Corps, the National Museum of the Pacific War, Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum, Kalamazoo Aviation History Museum, also known as the Kalamazoo Air Zoo, Cradle of Aviation, Long Island, New York, the aircraft carriers Yorktown, Lexington, Midway. So additionally, some of the aircraft were, because they understood this, that the population needs better chances to see them, a number of the aircraft we were allowed to, they exchanged them for us in a sense of payment and to other people for things. And they've been returned to the public. And there's aircraft that have come out of Lake Michigan that were restored to flying condition and are seen at air shows across the country every year.
Well, it's really amazing. The book talks about how, well, it's the government's aircraft still. We're spending all the effort and time in raising this, but we can't get paid for it. We've got to get something in that's traded like bartering exchange for it. It isn't finders keepers. It's really, you might be lucky enough to get a reward.
Yeah. And they don't make it easy. They really don't make it easy. It's amazing all the entire permitting process. There was a Navy lawyer that said, well, we think the permitting process takes about a year. And it's aside from seeing why, you know, the people did not understanding how to find them. When you look at the average person doesn't have all the expertise to find them and then to go through the government stuff. And that's why we were able to put together a team that could figure out how to do all that. And then when the Navy stopped using that exchange thing and shut off the exchange thing, we had to go raise private money. And it's very interesting, the private money that came in to support the recovery, restoration, and public display of these aircraft. Enterprise Rent-A-Car, well, Enterprise Holdings, which owns Enterprise Rent-A-Car, CEO and son of founder. A lot of people don't know Enterprise was named after the Enterprise aircraft carrier because the founder, Jack Taylor, was a Hellcat pilot aboard the USS Enterprise during World War II. So in honor of his father and that ship and the men, his son, Andy Taylor, sponsored the recovery and restoration of a Hellcat fighter. McDonald's Corporation, which was under at the time was under direction of a man named Fred Turner, who I think was the second CEO after Ray Kroc, backed at least three of the recovery restoration display projects. And that's an interesting story. And then there's other people such as a man named Chuck Greenhill, who sponsored two of the recoveries and restorations. So the Navy can't help us do that. The Navy can't help us raise money to do this stuff. Well, we have to go do it.
I want to go back to the challenge of actually lifting these airframes, which have been sitting on the bottom in Lake Michigan. At least it's freshwater, but you've also had recoveries elsewhere. Sitting on the bottom, 150 feet or 100 feet below the surface, or all kinds.
How about 400?
Okay. I mean, those of us who's ever scuba dived knows that the pressure is building. This is a logistical challenge and different each and every time, I suspect. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, all the aircraft, Navy aircraft, World War II, are designed to be lifted, and you understand that because, say, an aircraft carrier pulls into port, it might have aircraft that are damaged beyond what the aircraft carrier has capabilities to repair, so it's got to be lifted off the ship onto the dock and taken to repair facilities. So they're all designed to be that way, except for the design works if the aircraft is standing on its wheels the way it's built, right? The design doesn't work if it's flipped over, twisted on the side, half upside down. Right? So they could be in any position, because when they crash in the water, they don't just gently flutter to the bottom. They flip and spin and twist, and right, because they have control surfaces, which might be called air surfaces or whatever. So we never know exactly how the aircraft is going to be. So say we have an aircraft that's 300 feet deep. We videotape it with what's called remote operated vehicles, ROVs, what they call them. It's an underwater robot is what it is that we control from the surface. And it's got a nice camera, and it has what we call manipulators, which are mechanical hands or arms, which can be anything. It can cut, it can grab, it can attach things. My joke always is, because we tease each other about operating those things, and my joke is we need to hire some 14-year-old video game players, because they have the
skill set. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So anyway, it's a very lengthy, tedious thing, but as I said before, Al, Keith, Paul, Bruce, it can fabricate just about anything we need. So no matter how the aircraft is resting on the bottom, they can figure out how to pick it up. Generally, they can figure. And we have all the engineer drawings of the aircraft and what's called the erection maintenance manuals, where we know how to disassemble them, assemble them. We have got guys like Pete and Ty, who are AMP mechanics or even aircraft inspectors, that just can look at that stuff and tell us, hey, you need this here and you need that there. So we put together an absolutely unbelievable team that does this really well. We have Todd, who's great with logistics, it's one of those things, the stars line up. Our team lines up, because they just, whatever weaknesses one has, one of the other ones makes up for it. And
well, it's the kind of project where you never know what you're going to walk into, so having that kind of team is important. And we're talking to Taras Lysenko, who is the one of the founders and the author of a new book called The Great Navy Birds of Lake Michigan, put out by the America Through Time, which is an imprint of Font Hill Media LLC. The pictures in this, Taras, are amazing and worth the book right there. I think you really tell the story through the pictures of the airplanes that you find both on the bottom and as you bring them up to the surface. They're in all kinds of different conditions, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. the one thing about it, nice thing about it, in general, the crashes were – you would call them a ditching, because they were either generally on takeoff or on landing to the makeshift aircraft carriers. So they're not like combat crashes where, they were fighting a Japanese Zero and the pilot got hit by a round and killed. So the aircraft went into the water at 300 miles an hour. They generally were at very close to stall speed, which, and I don't think you want me to get into all the pilot stuff, but basically the stall speed, landing speed, takeoff speed, right? They were just at that point. So generally their damage isn't too bad. Now you see some of them that actually impacted the water wrong, and the wings are, the front end edges of the wings are folded back and that kind of stuff. And pilots, if in the accidents reports, the pilots would hit their faces on the instrument panels and fracture their skulls sometimes. But in general, that's pretty good. But there are ones where they lost their engine power on takeoff and crashed right in front of the ship, and the ship hit them. And so, you know, that aircraft is going to have a lot of damage. Interesting thing, we've recovered at least two aircraft that I know of that happened, and both the pilots survived. And I talk about having nine lives. those pilots used a few of them in those instances. But you look at the aircraft and they're heavily damaged by the ship.
And does anybody who's ever been in the service knows, and our veteran radio listeners would know, training accidents, training in the military is a serious, dangerous business. And this just sort of highlights all that. But I want to swing a little bit from the recovery to the restoration. It's one thing to pull these things out of the water and just let all the mud and the goop and drain out of them. But almost all of them then get restored, and that's got to take years and dollars. Who does the restoration?
I've got to say A&T Recovery doesn't do restoration. It is a tedious artisan work, and our hats off to these restorers, and most of them are volunteers. And the sad thing is most of them are in their 80s and 90s. They're generally retired people that have done something else, and they're brilliant. Funny thing, we look at something and say, oh, my God. They look at it and say, oh, that's a wonderful challenge. They take years. And for many years, the main restoration of these aircraft was being done at the National Naval Aviation Museum until the Naval History and Heritage Command shut down their restoration facilities, and I won't go into that, but if you read the book, you see what they did. But we were fortunate. The Kalamazoo Aviation History Museum, or the Air Zoo, stepped up to expand their restoration facilities. So if you're anywhere in Michigan or the Midwest, it's a great thing to go. They allow actually the public to participate in restoration, which is really interesting. We began a project by requesting of Dick and Betsy DeVos, our present education secretary, that they have a charter school called West Michigan Aviation Academy. We made a request to them that they bring their students to become involved in the restoration of some of these aircraft, and they responded to that right away and favorably. And so we began with the West Michigan Aviation Academy students back by 2013 or 2014. And since then, the schools all across the region, I would call it the South Central Michigan region, all the way as far as Chicago. The Chicago has high school military academies. Their students come and work on them. So it's middle school students all the way through university level students, and then lots of members of the public participate in the restoration of these aircraft now.
Well, and as you said earlier, these aircraft, once restored, have ended up all over the country, as far away as Pearl Harbor and down San Diego, at different museums, the National World War II Museum. So somebody's doing a whole lot of restoration work to keep this history alive, which is what you're really bringing to the table, isn't it? Bringing history alive.
Yes, that's I talk about the Naval History and Heritage Command. Well, part of their mission is to make naval history come alive. Well, I would argue that they're not doing it, but we are. You know, so all of us from the National Naval Aviation Museum, the Air Zoo, all these other museums, all these restorers, it takes thousands of people to participate to make this work. And so it's thousands of people doing what their mission is.
Well, you're out talking to different groups. I know you're coming to the Yankee Air Museum in Ypsilanti, Michigan, and they're working on a plane restoration for their museum. It's really that hands-on that I suspect you find motivates people to be involved in this work.
You know, people like the real thing. If show them a photograph of an aircraft or show them a video, so what? But if they can go and actually see machines built by the men and women of the greatest generation that were used to protect the world's liberty and freedom, that's what they want to see. And that's where they learn. And they can, in the Midway airports, or the Chicago airports, Chicago O'Hare and Midway, those are the most viewed naval artifacts in all the Navy's collection. And millions of people a year stop and press the little buttons or read the plaques that just tell them about things such as Butch O'Hare and the Battle of Midway. And they see the two aircraft recovered from Lake Michigan. And so every year, just those two aircraft educate millions of people, because most of our society has forgotten all that. They've forgotten that the greatest generation protected us.
Well, and that's why we like telling these stories on Veterans Radio, because so many people would never have really connected the dots about the training out of Great Lakes, the birds that crashed into Lake Michigan. And we're talking to Taras Lysenko, founder of A&T Restoration. He's recently written a book called The Great Navy Birds of Lake Michigan. And Taras, if folks want to find out maybe where you're speaking next or where the next plane is going to, is there some way that they can stay in touch with you and know what's going on in this area?
There are authors pages, but those are hard. I do a lot of posting on Facebook, LinkedIn. It's really easy to connect up or follow me on any one of those things. Believe it or not, my email is all over the internet. My phone number is all over the internet. So
let me help our listeners out. It's Taras, T-A-R-A-S, Lysenko, L-Y-S-S-E-N-K-O. And I hope they reach out and follow you on Facebook and LinkedIn and sort of stay in touch with what you do. And we really appreciate you taking some time to talk to us here today on Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you for the opportunity and keep up the good work.
I hope you enjoyed that on the Navy warbirds that are in Lake Michigan. I thought it was pretty interesting. And we certainly hope on Veterans Radio you did too. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook or go to veteransradio.net and kind of keep in touch with us. We do on Facebook often get recommendations from our listeners, so please do that. I said last time, Dale will be back next week. And until then, you are dismissed.